top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 418 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, The Boogeyman and Prey. You know, horror is a funny thing. This is the third film that I've seen called The Boogeyman, or some variant thereof, Boogeyman, The Boogeyman. One, I think I own it, but I'm not quite sure. I'm pretty sure I had it in my collection. It's from 2005, and I have no idea how I came by it. It's just a complete mystery, and I've since lost it, so it's probably for the best. But Lucy Lawless, Emily Deschanel was in this thing. It was completely forgettable. And then there was, when I was researching Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons with Jeff, we came upon Boogeyman, no definite article, which is an early 80s German horror film by Uli Lommel. And if I'm not mistaken, there's some sort of supernatural occurrence with some shattered mirror, and there's a couple kids, you know, it has one of these prologue things that was de rigueur for 80s horror at the time, where you have these two kids. I think they happen upon their mom having an affair with the neighbor, I don't know, with some sort of weird thing, and then the glass shattered and something came from the great beyond. But regardless, this is Boogeyman number 3. And this is from a series of short stories that Stephen King wrote. This is an adaptation. This was a late 70s, like before, I guess, King had really gotten leverage and became the Stephen King that we all know and love today. But this is way, way back when, I guess, King might have been an English teacher at the time and was toiling away in relative obscurity. It's almost impossible to even imagine that his work would go on to have this kind of resonance and have all these adaptations made of everything. They've really pilfered his back catalog to an incredible extent, with the likes of just about everything. I mean, it goes way beyond your Shinings, Dolores Claiborne's, Gerald's Game, and Firestarter. I almost said Firestorm, this awful Howie Long movie from the 90s action movie. But yeah, just so many of these films, and some of them obviously aren't of the highest quality, while others, I mean, people really warm to Dr. Sleep. It's one of the more engaging and better current ones, but it really, you know, it runs the gamut. They've been redone, you know, every sort of kernel has been, I'm mixing metaphors here. Every sort of last drop has been wrung out of the King catalog, and I was not altogether that big on Pet Sematary. I thought it was perfectly fine in the way that something is maybe a 6.5 out of 10. It was fine for what it was, and the performances were pretty good. They did a little switcheroo at the end. It was fine. It was perfectly, I guess, somewhat beyond just being sort of mediocre or adequate, but offered very little in terms of bringing more people into the fold. It's just one of these things where if you stick people with cell phones to prove that you're in the present day, and you just add a few au courant references, people think that's enough to justify just bringing an IP to light. And you could say it's a cash grab, not sure. But in the case of The Boogeyman, you have a really juicy premise. And this is something I actually saw in cinema, which is pretty exciting. It's been years since I've darkened the door of the local cinema, and this one is right in downtown Toronto. It was exciting to see the marquee and the the scroll going past it. And it's funny, last time I was in this cinema, I was at a company town hall, and one of my colleagues fell down the stairs at the end of the town hall and broke his foot in front of 100 of his coworkers, which is pretty amazing and pretty shocking. And you had this quite a scene of the paramedics rushing in, quite a to-do, not in the cinema I was in. It was one of the smaller ones. And but one of the larger ones next door, and it was quite remarkable to reconnect with the physical cinema-going experience. Because when you think about it, I mean, this was the dominant form of the arts and for 100 years, and has slowly slipping into, I guess, not irrelevance, but obsolescence in a certain way. And part of me was thinking about that as I was engaging with this film, in that there was all of, I think, 8 people in the cinema, and I, for some reason, pre-selected my tickets as as the option goes when you're buying stuff online a couple days in advance or whatever. And sure enough, a couple sat about a meter away from us and was just chomping away on nachos. It was and making like asides like they were the balcony crew from the Muppets, you know. And it was like, my God, this is an empty theater where they could have at least given us a little bit of grace, respected our space, and just, you know, given us at least like 3 or 4 meters and gone literally anywhere. But of course, they had to sit there and their, you know, their excruciating, you know, fucking mastications really put a dower on the proceedings. And it made me realize, like, I like a packed theater, but I don't want an empty theater, because that detracts as much as the packed one amplifies. Because especially in the case of a supernatural film, which is my least favorite genre, Italian horror excepted, and this one, there's a certain comfort level that comes from seeing these types of crappy movies in the cinema, because I wouldn't stream them at home for sure, but I do occasionally like to engage with what the masses are engaging with as well. And part of that is because of an ex-girlfriend who had an affinity for some of the softer horrors and some of the more mainstream PG-13 horrors, like your Annabelles and your Conjurings and that. So that's fine. I think there's a room in this big tent of horror fandom for just about anyone. And it's exciting to be able to go see a film like The Boogeyman that is not something I would ordinarily see. But the premise is really juicy, and it involves a therapist in this small town who has lost his wife in a car accident, and who's looking after 2 young daughters. And the trauma that the daughters are suffering, and really it all ladders back to what Stephen King details in his excellent, stellar nonfiction book, A Danse Macabre, that he basically says all of horror can really be summed up in the very parsimonious, very solid, and largely, I think, generalizable definition of being afraid of the dark. And this is, you know, and you could extend that to being afraid of something under the bed. And this is a concept and a conceit that the Boogeyman really, really dives into with the young daughter, who has this orb. And there's this fantastic directorial flourishes by Rob Savage, who did Dash Cam, which admittedly I bailed on, and The Host, or not The Host, but I guess it's Host, not to be confused with the South Korean horror. But that was another one that really didn't engage with me enough, so I didn't tackle that one. You know, she's got an orb and it lights the bottom of her bed, and she has to occasionally ask if she can sleep with her pops. And, you know, she's a kid, she's afraid of the dark, and this is so eminently relatable. And the Boogeyman explores this kind of trauma world in such an exemplary and tactful and brilliant way. And you could almost say that the grieving horror could almost occupy a subset of the horror genre, in, I think, ever since Hereditary came to prominence. That was just an expertly crafted exploration of the grieving process and how different families cope with it. And as well, the first 45 minutes of The Boogeyman is. And you have, you know, Sadie, who's the older daughter, who comforts the younger one and really misses her mom. And you have these quite touching scenes where she's actually putting on her mom's dress to, I guess, get a sense of her spirit and her embodiment, her smells, like everything that she represented in life. And she goes to school and she has these interactions with her classmates, one of whom spills yogurt on this important heirloom, this important garment. And you have this really rich, richly told little internal world that's really quite amazing and quite singular and quite affecting. And then there's a point where one of her dad's patients just shows up out of the blue, unannounced, without calling ahead, without booking, without going through the proper channels, and he has quite a story to tell, without spoiling too much. But his ultimate demise is what sets in motion a series of events here, and his death leads Sadie down the garden path to the man's widow, and it turns out that he has been linked to, or he thinks he's responsible for the death and the murder of his own, I think he's a father of three. And you have a family photo that you get this wonderful zoom in at the outset of the film, where you don't really know what exactly is going on or from whose perspective the story will be told. And it's quite delectable and quite delicious and quite impressive till we get to this almost insane, almost Halloween, Laurie Strode 2018 moment, where you have the widow of this man who commits a suicide, and she's all holed up and fighting demons in her house, which has been booby-trapped. And this is where things, I guess, fall apart, and the self-contained quiet world of the house and the horrors therein and the memories and the long shadows cast, literally and figuratively, by the deceased morphs into this just nuttiness and craziness, and you have these creatures from the beyond. It's almost like the Stan Winston effects from Pumpkinhead or something, where this creature, I mean, it's well done, but it doesn't suit the tenor and timbre of the kind of supernatural effect and the ghost story storytelling and the monster under the bed that you really that the first half of this movie tries to capture. And it's something, I think, that's a problem with a lot of supernatural films, is that you have to marry something that's the physical with and the corporeal with something that's beyond that. So if you can kill something, then presumably it's physical and you can kill it. Otherwise, you can't, and it exists like some sort of Michael Myers, paranormal entity. And usually it's one or the other that you got to live with. And in this case, when the demon is brought from the beyond, it's something I think does a disservice to the boogeyman. And I think they could have, I don't know to what extent you would want to deviate from the King source material from 1978, but I think it sort of loses its steam around this midpoint, where again you have Sadie becoming an investigator and looking around to see what happened with this mysterious patient and this complete stranger who commits suicide in front of her therapist dad. The family dynamics are so good. The performances are so amazing, especially the therapist. I forget his name, but he's in the Mindy Kaling show. He's quite good. Everyone in the cast is just dynamite. And it's a kind of a situation where this scenario and the setup is wasted, and especially it can be difficult to get high school lives correct with the dialogue and the sensibilities, and not everyone can be John Hughes, right? It's hard to really get these things down, but the family dynamic here was just expert. Not to mention the fact that the two kids are seeing a therapist on their own, and they have a therapist dad, and they're struggling, and these all different interwoven dynamics are so great. Now, switching gears a little, there's this German film called Prey, which owes so much to Deliverance, you'd think that some henchmen would come along and break their kneecaps. Like, this is an insane ripoff of Deliverance, down to the number of people who are out on the trip. I think in the case of the stellar 1972, I want to say it's John Boorman who directed it, but the James Dickey novel, which I also read, and it's just absolutely just mind-boggling and really, really good. And you get to see how the filmmakers alter Deliverance to suit their needs and ultimately make a better product in the end. But when you see a film like Prey, and you have basically a bunch of campers getting hunted by hunters, there's very little to offer in this film other than a female who's a sharpshooter and chasing these guys through the woods. But it just doesn't have that same really rich and really powerful extra character that would be the gushing, the rapids and the rushing river from Deliverance, which is a character unto itself and which provides a soundtrack which is ultimately very, very disquieting and very, very, very unnerving. I mean, when you think about it, even if you don't like water, I mean, everyone, I think, really has a little antipathy or a little bit of fear toward rushing water that you know could kill you if you're in a canoe and you tip and it just have you drown or smash you into the rocks. It's something that I think it's a fear that is fairly prevalent and fairly common and fairly commonplace, fairly widespread. And in Deliverance, you have this amazing setup where not only are these guys on this camping trip being hunted, but they're being hunted from above almost as if they were small mammals and their predator were like some sort of a peregrine falcon or something. Like they're all looking up and they're always, there's nothing that can, there's no escape from this gorge, and this gorge is so powerful and so all-encompassing, and all that they have to go on is this little, like, you know, faces that may appear over the horizon line and on the top of the gorge. So not only do they have to battle the elements and this raging river, you know, they're being targeted, and it's the kind of thing that just this kind of idea is just transplanted to the Black Forest in Germany. And it really doesn't have that kind of rich geographical backdrop that Deliverance does. And the characters are also not nearly as engaging, nor are the actors nearly as good as that iconic cast from the 1972 Deliverance. They're sort of sketchily put together. Not one of them is some sort of tech bro who invested in some startup. They're not, none of these gentlemen is a particularly engaging figure in their own right. And I tried, I have passable conversational German, so I tried flipping it in between to see if there were some nuances that might have worked better in the Teutonic language, but it was just a case of these guys were pretty, there's not much depth to these guys. It's all patina, all surface level. And you could say that having a sharpshooter who's a woman adds a little bit of a twist to what is a pretty common horror trope of just a bunch of victims lost in the woods who are being hunted. This is something we've seen 1,000 times. It's been done better in numerous cases. The only novelty of this, in addition to having a female antagonist, is the fact that, yes, it's filmed in Europe, but that comes with it, you know, a certain set of expectations in my eyes as well. It's the Black Forest is near where my opa lived. I'm fairly familiar with the region, and, you know, it's, if you're going to make something remote and you want to give people the feel of what remoteness is actually all about, I mean, we get remoteness in North America and they don't in somewhere like, you know, Germany or like England or something, where you can't possibly get lost. And I maintain, well, maybe you could in the German Alps or something, but everything is like, you know, you're like 50K away from the nearest town. You can just hike out of there. It's not a problem. Whereas there are, you know, parts of Northern Ontario where they will need multiple helicopters to find your ass, and by that time you're basically bear chow. So yeah, but it was interesting to see. There's different lookout points and different vantage points, and the European sensibilities that come from this, and the fact that I think the film Prey even admits and shows its hand that it's not exactly way out in the bush. So these four or five guys get pot-shotted at by these hunters. They seek cover, and of course, as par for the course, they start to bicker with one another, a la the Canadian Deliverance, which is a Rituals, the Hal Holbrook film, which is actually quite good of its type. I'm hoping they have a Blu-ray edition of it, because as I refer to it as, it's the Canadian Deliverance, and there's this whole undercurrent of indigenous stuff that infuses that. That one's filmed in Northern Ontario and it's worth checking out, and I've mentioned it. Fans of the Really Awful Movies podcast will have heard that name mentioned quite a bit, but it's quite captivating and obviously not as good as Deliverance, but pretty good. Another one of this type that listeners should check out would be Southern Comfort. I forget which Carradine is in it, but that's really dynamite as well. And in that one, you have some Louisiana National Guard types, and they get shot at by these, you know, mysterious characters. So that's always rife for exploration, and it's a canvas on which you can paint a lot of different things when you have people who are being hunted basically in the woods. There's lots of films of this type, and I think it's called Hunting Ground or Killing Ground, a very, very good Australian horror of a couple campers in the outback who get targeted. Really exemplary. So if you check out Hunting Ground or Killing Ground, came out in around 2017, really, really stellar stuff. Prey is eminently forgettable. I think the first half of The Boogeyman is just wonderful and just on point. The latter half really lets it down. So two films that are a bit of a letdown, but for different reasons, probably in the neighborhood of 2.75 out of 5 for both, maybe pushing it to 3 for The Boogeyman, which has about a 63 rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And I think there's a lot of people who have taken umbrage with some of the cliches that have come to haunt, pardon the pun, some of the supernatural films of the creaky door and the footsteps and the ball rolling down the corridor. Fair point. It's not my favorite genre, so I'm maybe not the best person to speak to it, but I think there's more to credit than to take away for The Boogeyman, and just don't go into it thinking that this is going to be some higher order king vehicle on the likes of, on the same precipice and the same level, the same peak as The Shining or one of these things, but or a Gerald's Game, which I'm really, really fond of. That one really, really got me in my core, and I think that was a stellar one. But this one is sort of middle of the pack king, definitely not one of the worst ones. There's a ton of those streaming on Netflix, of course. Definitely not one of the better ones, but enough to satiate you if you want to head to Cineplexes, wherever you happen to be. Anyway, that's the latest episode of the show. Talk to you soon, and take care. Thank you.